What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the so-called nuclear experts get it wrong. This week, we present a new Voices from Japan. The feature we began with the Fukushima anniversary special 3 weeks ago. You will hear directly from a father who voluntarily evacuated his family from Fukushima, and also from the attorney who filed the collective evacuation lawsuit in Japan on behalf of the children of Fukushima. Powerful, deeply felt, from people directly caught up in the ongoing nuclear disaster in Japan. We also catch up with Gene Stone for an update on public panel discussions on the decommissioning of San Onofre. Lots of lessons for activists in what he has to say. And Don Hancock of Southwest Research and Information Center once again provides cutting-edge information on what's happening with the radiation leak at the Waste Isolation Project Plant, WIP, in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Those interviews, plus Numbnuts of the Week and the Radcast Radiation Weather Report in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 1st, 2014, and we're not fooling around. Here is the week's anti-nuclear news. We start this week with an update on the most important nuclear story currently happening in the United States, the follow-up on the February 14 radiation leak at the Waste Isolation Project plant in Carlsbad, New Mexico. We again speak with Don Hancock of Southwest Research and Information Center, based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Don has been a rock about giving us solid information we can trust about what's happening at the WIP site.
Don, what is the current status of the WIP site?
Well, things haven't changed very much. We still don't know what happened and why it happened and all those important things. What is supposed to happen starting today is that some workers, 8 workers, are supposed to actually go underground and physically step back into the mine. They would be starting a process that will go on for days or weeks, most likely, if not longer, to try to figure out what happened and what may be done about it. So these are workers that will be going down and starting this process starting today.
What kind of special protection are they wearing as they go into this area?
They've supposedly been trained and are supposedly will have a variety of protective equipment, up to and including 2 different self-breathing apparatus, one that will last for an hour or so and one that would last considerably longer than that. They will have a variety of protective equipment, supposedly, that they can use depending on what they actually run into, and they will, of course, have radiation detection equipment and will have also, importantly, detection equipment for toxic chemicals and volatile organic compounds, because what's in the waste, the WIP waste, is both radioactivity, americium, 241, and plutonium, various elements of plutonium, including 239, but also a lot of toxic chemicals. And so they need protection from and monitoring for, in addition to radioactivity, also the chemicals. So the Department of Energy has said they've carefully trained these people. They are going to be fully equipped. Part of the reason they need to first go down and establish a base camp is to make sure that they have 2 ways to get in and out of the mine if something happens, that they have good communication with the surface, so they can move quickly if they need to abandon the mine and get out quickly.
What is known about the radiation leak? I variously read that it was two isolated puffs of radiation, and I've also read that it's possible that there has been continuous radiation leakage from the site through the vents. How much has been acknowledged by the authority, and what, if anything, is known?
Well, the Department of Energy likes to talk about this as a one-time event, although their own modeling study that was released in March said that the one-time event lasted for 15 and a half hours. The actual data from what's being captured coming out of the underground and before it goes through the filters and then what comes out of the filters is that there have been continuing releases, essentially 24/7, much lower amounts, much lower amounts since the first couple, 3 or 4 days of the release from the data. But there still is contamination coming out of the underground and then being filtered, and there are then lesser amounts of radioactivity, a becquerel or so, coming out of what's called Station B, the filter system, right before it's released into the environment. So the biggest amount of release seem to have been early on February 14, 15, and maybe 17 or 18, but the numbers move around, but they are always, there is always some amount of radioactivity in the underground air and being, and lesser amounts being vented into the environment. But why it happened, how much was really released, how much contamination there is in the underground, how long the release will continue, whether there could be further releases, given that we don't know what the situation is in the underground, all of those things are unknowns.
Has there been any testing of the soil yet?
The Department of Energy, the New Mexico Environment Department, and the Carlsbad Environmental Monitoring and Research Center are all doing soil sampling. There has been actual information data released only by the Department of Energy on a small number of their samples, which they generally show to be less than detectable levels given the equipment that they're using. We certainly think that it's not credible to think that 21 workers breathed in contamination and the only place that there is contamination is on the workers. There clearly has to have been soil contamination. DOE's own modeling shows that there would be extensive soil contamination around the site. So there is a lot more soil sampling that needs to be done. There is the data on what that sampling shows need to be made publicly available. So, again, this is one of the many things that we don't know how much came out and where it is now.
The number of contaminated workers are now up to 21, which is 4 more than when we last spoke. Is that number expected to go up?
We don't know whether it will go up. We know that there are still more than 40 workers that are still waiting for results, urine, fecal, or whole body lung count that they have done. In other words, the tests have been taken and the laboratory results aren't back yet. So it certainly is possible that there will be more than 21 given what's still out there. So, yes, we think it's unfortunately possible that it does happen. This is totally unacceptable. There were 13 workers on site on the surface when the release started. There was no reason that other workers should have come in and have been contaminated. And so it's a major failure by the Department of Energy and Nuclear Waste Partnership, the operating contractor, that anybody was contaminated, of course, because there was never supposed to be this radiation release at all, ever, in 10,000 years. So the fact that all the workers who were on the surface at the time that the release was first detected were contaminated is awful in its own right, but the fact that there are other workers who have been contaminated is totally unacceptable. It's been the fastest workers were told that they were contaminated was February 26th, almost 12 days after the event. the most recent workers, the most recent four workers. It was more than a month after the event that they were told they were contaminated, after they had been, these four workers were previously told that they weren't contaminated. So this is a continuing horrible case of the Department of Energy and the contractor not knowing what they're doing, not properly informing the workers. And as far as we can tell, DOE hasn't recommended that any of the 21 workers seek medical help. So that's, again, another horrific practice that the Department of Energy seems to be going through right now.
So are these workers getting any treatment at all, to the best of your knowledge?
I don't know. As I say, the Department of Energy has not been totally clear, but in terms of both my inquiries and some media inquiries, it appears that DOE is not recommending any medical treatment. We know that the Department of Energy isn't recommending any additional testing or planning to do any additional testing on their own of even the 21 workers, let alone any of the others. As far as we know publicly, there is no information that the 21 workers are getting their own medical treatment. We hope that is happening. Some of the workers are unionized, and there have certainly been discussions among the Steel Workers Union, for example, about the need for medical treatment and independent health advice, et cetera, but we don't know whether that's actually happening or not.
The former director of Carlsbad Environmental Mentoring and Research Center, James Konka, has said that WIP will be closed for at least a year, while renowned anti-nuclear activist Dr. Helen Kalnicott has predicted that WIP will never be able to be used again. How accurate do you believe these predictions are?
We don't know, and nobody knows, and the Department of Energy itself hasn't said when or if WIP will reopen. The fact that we don't know any of the basic things that would need to be known, what caused the release in the first place, how to stop it, whether the underground can be decontaminated, how to decontaminate the surface, how to deal with the worker health problems, et cetera. None of those things are known. We do know that there is no instance in the world where you have a underground salt mine significantly contaminated with radiation and toxic chemicals. So there is no experience in dealing with this situation. So we're, you know, starting from square one, so to speak. It will be difficult, if not impossible, and also very costly to clean up the underground. Based on my 38 years of experience in working with the Department of Energy, I find it virtually inconceivable. I hope they will decide, if they can't do total cleanup of the underground, I hope they will decide not to reopen it. But my experience is they will say they can reopen, they can do some amount of cleanup or putting stuff on the walls to try to fix the contamination in place, and then it would be okay for workers to go back in the underground, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they will be exposed to radioactivity for as long as the site opens, but, you know, that will be acceptable. I don't agree with that, but that's the kind of thing that I think could happen, which is why I and many other people think we need an independent investigation of outside technical people to look at what happened, what can be done about it, whether there can be decontamination, what kind of decontamination options there would be, how to deal with the workers and potentially the public. As I said, it's a long time after they were contaminated that the workers were told, so therefore they have been in their vehicles, they have been in their homes, they have been in contact with their family members. So we need an extensive screening of vehicles, homes, and family members, in my view, but we also need independent analysis and independent medical people, but we also need independent technical folks to look at what happened and why it happened and what kind of decontamination could be done, if any.
Don, thank you so much. We will continue to be in touch to get further updates on what's happening at WIP.
Don Hancock of Southwest Research and Information Center. One more piece on WIP. The press and government officials in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, population 2.5 million and only 200 miles from the WIP site, are anxious about the radiation release. Despite U.S. and Mexican government reports of little or no radiation contamination from the WIP leak,
Note that there is a difference between little and no radiation contamination. The public doubts about the gravity of the February 14th incident persist due to incomplete contamination data reporting, the slowness in getting all the potentially exposed workers tested and informed, spotty or contradictory statements by regulatory officials, and uncertainties over the origin of the radiation leak and how far an area it has impacted. Back in the 1990s, Ciudad Juarez and U.S. environmentalists from the Rio Bravo Ecological Alliance took a stand against WIP based partly on concerns that the underground storage facility would eventually contaminate the Pecos River Basin and the Rio Grande. If we're not careful, pretty soon people will be going the other way over the U.S.-Mexican border. Here's the other big story in the U.S. Six workers at the Hanford site in Washington State were sickened last Wednesday from ingesting chemical vapors at the nuclear facility. This brings the total to 17 Hanford employees who have needed medical care since last Wednesday due to the inhalation of toxic vapors. Their symptoms include a metallic taste in the mouth, nosebleeds, and upper respiratory difficulties, all of which would be consistent with exposure to high-level radiation. Mike Jeffrey, a retired employee of WRPS, which is the company that runs the site, and who spent 26 years at Hanford, explained, "It's pretty scary. It doesn't usually happen like this. Usually you see four or five a year. But to have this many in 8 days is really abnormal. Whenever you hear of someone getting tank vapors, you never know what the long-term effects are going to be. The effects of exposures like this can show up as health problems years down the line." In the three separate incidents, the workers were all at different locations at Hanford. So this isn't just one problem area where they're seeing a repeat problem. Workers are concerned, and they want their employer and the Department of Energy to do something about it. Good luck with that. Activist Steve Zeltzer, reporting from Japan for KPFA's Flashpoints, said, "Activists here in Osaka are being threatened, including Professor Shimoji, who was arrested for handing out leaflets. The government is trying to suppress opposition to nuclear power by passing the secrecy law and also by intimidating anti-nuclear activists and saying they have to keep quiet. Students from different universities are reporting that they're being repressed and being charged with disturbing the peace for handing out flyers against the burning of nuclear rubble and against nuclear power plants. We've also learned from Dr. Helen Caldicott that she was threatened. She spoke at a meeting in Kyoto on the 8th of March, and it was reported at the meeting that she had been threatened by right-wingers with death for speaking out about the dangers of nuclear power." So much for democracy in Japan. Here's a fun story out of Canada. Alberta high school student Bronwyn De La Cruz loves sushi, but she became concerned last summer after learning how little food inspection actually takes place on some of its key ingredients. The 10th grade student from Grand Prairie, Alberta, said she was shocked to discover that, in the wake of the 2011 Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency stopped testing imported foods for radiation in 2012. So she decided to carry out her own tests. Armed with a $600 Geiger counter bought by her dad, De La Cruz studied a variety of seafoods, particularly seaweeds, as part of an award-winning science project. She said, "Some of the kelp I found was higher than what the International Atomic Energy Agency sets as radioactive contamination, which is 1,450 counts over a 10-minute period. Some of my samples," she said, "came up as high as 1,700 or 1,800 counts over a 10-minute period." De La Cruz said the samples that lit up most were products from China that she bought in local grocery stores. De La Cruz hopes to catch the attention of lawmakers in Ottawa with a petition urging the federal government to do more radiation testing on food. What one person with a will, some smarts, and a little bit of equipment can do to influence the course, we hope, of the nuclear issue. Meanwhile, over in Japan, it's time for
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
At Fukushima, it's a well-known fact that more than 400 tons of groundwater enters the basements of the reactor buildings each day through cable and pipe penetrations, as well as small cracks, where it mixes with the heavily contaminated water previously used to cool the ruined reactor cores. Some water leaves the buildings in similar ways, causing high levels of contamination to be found in test wells near the sea. Well, this created a PR dilemma for the Fukushima Prefecture's Fishermen's Union. They were concerned about the impact on the public image of their products from TEPCO releasing water from the site. They were not concerned about the actual safety, just the image. So TEPCO came up with a plan, and the Fishermen's Union approved it. TEPCO's proposal? They're going to sink a line of 12 wells inland from the reactor buildings and pump water out of the ground before it has a chance to become contaminated, according to them. It would then be checked and discharged into the sea. Checked for what and what levels would be set? That was not stipulated. Now, the nuke industry is proud of saying that this bypass could reduce the leakage of water to the basements by 100 tons per day, leaving 300 tons per day completely unaccounted for. The fishermen insisted that water TEPCO releases must be below an agreed limit of 10 becquerels per liter of either cesium-134 or 137. Now, the nuclear industry insists that this is a highly conservative reading at only one-tenth the level deemed acceptable by the World Health Organization. But who is who to deem anything acceptable in the nuclear arena? It's well known that they've said nothing honest about nuclear issues or radiation levels or health dangers since 1959, when they came into an unholy legal alliance with the International Atomic Energy Agency that, in essence, muffled and neutered the World Health Organization. This is just bureaucratic busy work to create the impression that something is happening when it doesn't look like anything is. And that's why TEPCO and the Fishermen's Union of Fukushima, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
So what does a genuine decommissioning process at a nuclear reactor look like? We turned to an activist expert to fill us in. Gene Stone is the founder of Residents Organized for a Safe Environment in Southern California. He's a longtime activist against the San Onofre nuclear reactors. San Onofre is shut down, but what about the end game, dealing with the waste? That's what we spoke to Gene about.
Gene, bring us up to speed on what's been happening at San Onofre since the plant was shut down last year.
Libby, the license has changed at San Onofre. They are no longer licensed to produce nuclear power, but they are licensed to store nuclear waste. So as the decommissioning process is going forward, Edison has not filed the information yet of how they're going to start proceeding in the first phase. That's the first thing that needs to happen. They have about another 6 months to file those papers with the NRC. So to start off, they have formed the California Edison's Community Engagement Panel, known as the CEP. I like to constantly refer to it as California Edison's Community Engagement Panel because they selected it. They had the only input about who was on it. I like to, instead of just calling it the Community Engagement Panel, I think it's important for us to always say the California Edison's Community Engagement Panel. California Edison has selected several elected officials from San Diego County, Orange County, and two local environmentalists. I'm fortunate that I was one, I'm the only anti-nuclear activist on the panel, and when I met with them the other day, I said, well, as the token anti-nuclear environmentalist here, I will endeavor to speak for the public and bring up the issues that are often glossed over. So in the first meeting on the 25th of March that we just had, the meeting was set up in such a way that Tom Palmer was going through the procedures. And so
now, playing that he is the head engineer, head presenter on behalf of Edison.
He took Dietrich's job. He is the new person in charge at the plant itself.
And the two of you had an interesting conversation immediately before the presentation. Fill in the listeners on what it consisted of.
It came up that how we were going to ask questions, right? So he said, I would rather you interrupt me so that you don't forget your question. So it enabled me to rebut him every time he didn't tell the whole truth. And I didn't really catch him lying at all, but he just wasn't telling the whole side. So it just set up just perfectly. So he went on. He started off immediately just giving the glossy side, the Edison side of the story, and I was able to just, like, nail him every time. So it worked out really well. That enabled me to, when he had glossed over many of the items from the Edison point of view, that I was able to give the environmental point of view, meaning in Paul Harvey terms, to give the rest of the story, which they don't like to talk about. For an example, here's one of the issues that they didn't want to state publicly necessarily, but we were talking about storage of spent fuel. And the NRC, as you know, last year made every nuclear power plant virtually a nuclear waste dump for 299 years. Now, obviously, their intent is not necessarily to have them to be a nuclear waste dump for that long, but that gives them long enough to make some sort of decisions and find some place at the rate that Congress moves. It could take that long. So it was important that the public knew that San Onofre and every other nuclear power plant could become a nuclear waste dump, which they have never been licensed for by the public or the state of California, or even the NRC for that point.
So Paul Masano was trying to gloss over this point, and you got to interrupt him and bring it up?
Interrupt's not the right word. I just was able to, you know, ask a question, and then, of course, that is the fact, so he couldn't deny that. And so we kind of had that dance going on all evening about when he would say something and gloss over something that I would bring up the rest of the story, so to speak.
Where are we now in terms of the decommissioning process and public input, and where do you see this going?
We're in the very beginning phases of it, but this is what's so important. Let me tell you our goals for our anti-nuclear activists wanted to achieve at the meeting. First of all, we wanted to educate many of the elected officials who were on this panel that we had not contacted during the shutdown fight. And so we did not know and were not aware of how much they understood about the problems. So that was our first and main goal, was to educate the CEP members themselves about the whole issue, not just part of the issue, not the Edison side of the story, but the whole story. We did that very well, to the point that actually some of the members, we had four or five really strong allies who were shocked. You can see it on people's faces when you watch this video. You can see it on people's faces that there's information that brought up by myself and the public during the public comment section that they were totally unaware of. Many of these people were totally unaware of. Our second goal, in the charter of the California Edison CEP panel, it states that the CEP itself can put on events, educational events for the public, to teach them about the process, what's going on, and the issues. Of course, the main issue is not just the decommissioning of the plant. It's the safety of the workers in the process. Is the spent fuel. So the spent fuel, they had no idea that we had 58 times more spent fuel than Chernobyl on site. Many of the members of the panel were shocked to hear that information.
I'm shocked because I've never heard that piece of information. That's terrifying.
It's very terrifying. You know, we have, I believe it equates to 5 times more nuclear waste on site than Fukushima. So these are the facts that many people didn't know. So our second goal to try to achieve at this first meeting was to get people on board to presenting some sort of symposium about nuclear waste and the problems thereof. It's really funny because just yesterday I read this article by the pro-nuclear industry, an article out of England. It says that the decommissioning process, it's all about the decommissioning process, and it says planning first for nuclear waste is the top priority in the decommissioning a plant. So that's what we wanted to talk to. Now, they didn't want to talk about the spent fuel necessarily yesterday or on the 25th, but we forced the issue and we brought it up. And so what was really great, this is when you know that you're having a really successful meeting. Our agenda was taken over by others on the panel.
Meaning some of the politicians were able to pick up the questioning line and then push it forward?
Exactly. So I didn't even have to suggest, although I did in my opening statement, but I didn't even have to suggest because four or five of the elected officials took up the banner of having our first event about nuclear waste and the storage thereof. So that was very gratifying to see other people picking up the banner and going forward. And I've been working on those issues since then. I've already contacted the NRC to see if they would be interested in sending a representative to an event like that that the CEP is going to put on to talk about high burn-up fuel from their point of view. And then the other thing that we've been asking for, and we will continue to demand, and I will as a member of the CEP, is that we have independent experts like Marvin Resnikoff, Arne Gunderson, and just not the pro-nuclear side presenting their evidence. But what I'd like to see is what you would say is a fair and balanced approach by all parties and a true public meeting with dissenting points of view being part of the process so that the public can get the real information.
Any final thoughts for us at this time?
This is one thing that I'd like to leave with all the activists around the world. It's very important to develop relationships with the people that run these nuclear power plants. They are not our enemies on a human level. And so we just happen to disagree about certain things. So the more that we can treat these people as human beings on a personal level and start connecting with them and developing relationships, that is how we will move forward. Edison stated that they want to do the best decommissioning possible. Well, that is a very high goal from a company that's not very well trusted by its neighbors around here. So our goal is to hold them to that, and that's what we intend to do in this process so that we have the safest decommissioning possible for everyone. It's just so important for us to start working with people because in the decommissioning process itself, we have different issues about safety. But everybody's on the same page. The plant is shut down. We don't have to fight about shutting the plant down. We have to just make sure that we accomplish the goals that have been set out. And the other factor that's interesting in decommissioning, if we're going to have a cutting-edge decommissioning, that means that we are going to have to solve nationwide some of the issues around storage of nuclear waste. So this is a very exciting time for all activists to get on board. Everyone should be using the fact that high burn-up fuel is in their reactors to shut it down. And then we're going to also have to use the high burn-up fuel issue to solve the nuclear waste problem. While that's a lot of work, that's good work for us all to be attuned to and how to make that happen.
Gene, you and the rest of the activists have been doing such a phenomenal job dealing with San Onofre, both as the shutdown was going on, the battle for that, and now in the wake of it. And we will continue to be in touch with you here on Nuclear Hot Seat to find out exactly what's going on and model this process, because as activists in the rest of the country succeed in shutting down their local nuclear plant, this is going to be the next stage in the battle. So well done to you and everyone else, and we look forward to following up again on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Jean Stone of Residents Organized for a Safe Environment. A reminder here that Nuclear Hot Seat is a completely volunteer enterprise that does have expenses. I'm reliant on donations to cover my ongoing expenses, most specifically bandwidth charges, because the more popular the podcast becomes, the more expensive it is for everyone to be able to download it. So what I ask is, at minimum, take what you would spend for a Starbucks this month and send it as a donation to Nuclear Hot Seat. You can do so by going to nuclearhotseat.com and on the homepage, scroll down to the big red donate button. Just click it and follow the prompts. Know that anything you can do to support this ongoing work on behalf of the anti-nuclear movement worldwide is appreciated. This week, we continue with our first-person accounts from Japan by those directly impacted by the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster. Voices from Japan is an ongoing feature that began with episode number 142, the Fukushima Anniversary Special. Nuclear Hot Seat is providing the opportunity for these people to speak directly to the world. There are still many people living in contaminated areas around Fukushima, forced to remain because of family commitments or for economic reasons. They live with the worry that constant exposure to radiation will cause future health problems, but the national and prefectural governments have been resistant to providing evacuation assistance, asserting that low-level exposure, which to them means under 20 millisieverts annually, has no adverse health effects. The collective evacuation lawsuit is an effort to, at the very least, protect children from further exposure in this situation. The case was made that children have a right to education in a safe place where radiation levels are lower than 1 millisievert per year. The case has been filed twice and was rejected both times. Toshio Yanagihara is the attorney who filed the lawsuit. Here, he explains more about the complicated details of the case. Mr. Yanagihara, your case was heard for a second time at the High Court in Sendai, where the decision was once again not in your favor. The reasoning is extremely difficult to understand. Can you tell us a little more about this?
この種のですね、裁判、いわゆるまあこれ科学裁判といって、科学的な評価を加えて結論を出す裁判ですね。そういう科学裁判で、
This type of litigation has two tiers. First, there is a scientific lawsuit, where scientific evidence pertaining to the dispute is examined before a decision is reached. Based on that decision, the next step considers which laws are germane to the dispute. The unique point of the collective evacuation lawsuit was that the first scientific portion of the decision was taken 99% in our favor. We argued that the children's health and lives are in serious danger due to low-level radiation exposure. The judgment even stated that to protect the children's health, the only alternative was evacuation. At first, the reasoning made us feel like we had won the case. We could even say that the initial phase was perfect. But when we moved into the second phase, the situation changed. There was a lot of reasoning and logic, but to put it simply, they said that although it is dangerous for children, families should go ahead and evacuate on their own if they agree about the danger. But the government is obligated to provide a safe place for children to be educated. And this obligation is what we stressed. Unfortunately, the municipality of Koriyama said that they don't have that obligation in this case. I was so surprised that the court would say that the children are in danger on one hand, but reject the idea that the evacuation is required.
It looks like a timely evacuation of the children is going to be difficult. What do you think is going to happen from now on? And are there any efforts to try to help the children despite the situation?
I don't really want to say this, but in Chernobyl, after 4 or 5 years, everyone thought the accident was over, that it was okay to return to regular life. But after the five-year mark, health effects increased dramatically, and many people were taken aback. They felt like they had been lied to and betrayed, and finally became angry. Their protests led to standards being set for evacuation of citizens. We have the example of Chernobyl. I did not want to repeat what happened there, which is why we filed the collective evacuation lawsuit. It hasn't been easy. The media has ignored us, and we are misunderstood. But it was announced in early February this year that 74 children have already tested positive for thyroid cancer. This is 35 times the amount of children in Belarus at the three-year mark. The meaning of this is very serious. Aside from thyroid cancer, there will be other health effects, such as leukemia and immune disorders. Thyroid cancer is just one illness, but it is also a sign that we can surmise that other things might be wrong too. In Belarus, health problems sharply rose at the 4 and 5 year mark. It will soon be 4 and then 5 years after Fukushima. I can't imagine what kind of panic will ensue. When I think about that, I believe that the only option is evacuation. So we need to go back to square one and start over. Having to file a lawsuit like this is strange. Upper House member Taro Yamamoto says, "Why do we have to file such a lawsuit? If the administration had instituted a policy of evacuation, we wouldn't have to file this lawsuit." Because the administration didn't do anything, citizens have to express their dissent somehow. This lawsuit is saying, "What the hell are you doing? I'm embarrassed that I have to file a case like this. The Japanese government is shameful. 3 years have already passed since the accident, and there is still no evacuation policy. Waiting around for a legal decision is going to delay help for the children. So we feel that in addition to the trial, we need to start a voluntary evacuation assistance project. From April this year, we are supporting a long-term evacuation boarding school project with the city of Matsumoto in Nagano. The mayor there, Dr. Akira Sugenoya, spent 5.5 years at Chernobyl as a medical volunteer and performed many thyroid surgeries. This evacuation project is known as the Matsumoto model. And there are several municipalities and citizens groups that are preparing similar programs. We are now pursuing two pillars in our efforts to help the children: the collective evacuation lawsuit and the evacuation boarding school project. We hope everyone will help support us with donations or by raising awareness. Please feel free to contact us. We are waiting to hear from you.
An English subtitled video of Toshio Yanagihara in 2012 speaking at the United Nations and other links relevant to this story will be up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog, under episode number 145. Katsumi Hasegawa lived with his wife and two small children in Koriyama City, 35 miles from Fukushima Daiichi. Koriyama was heavily contaminated by the Fukushima accident, but the Japanese government issued no evacuation orders. To protect his children from radiation, in August of 2011, Hasegawa and his family voluntarily evacuated to Shizuoka, 186 miles from Fukushima. Since then, Katsumi has become an outspoken critic of the government's policies and a tireless advocate for protecting all children from the risks of radiation. On March 4th of this year, he was part of a delegation that met with American linguist, philosopher, and human rights advocate Noam Chomsky in Tokyo to discuss the severe conditions faced by victims of the Fukushima Daiichi accident.
I 5 months after the Fukushima accident, my whole family chose the course of voluntary evacuation. Even though Fukushima was aiming at economic recovery, there were many uncertainties we faced in protecting our children's health. It took great resolve for us to commit to voluntary evacuation. After many discussions late into that night, we decided that even if others would say that we were throwing away our jobs, hometown, and credibility, the one thing we couldn't throw away was our children. We are prepared for this reaction and were proud of our decision. Several years from now, if our children were to become ill, even if the government were to pay compensation, it would be impossible to recover their health. There is also the possibility that the effects would not be limited to our children, but also impact the DNA of our grandchildren. There is no one at all who could take responsibility for such an outcome. This is how I came to choose the path of voluntary evacuation. There are many children still living in Fukushima. Even now, 3 years after the disaster, the national and local governments are allowing a 20 millisievert annual dose of radiation. There are even some who say that there is no proof of harm up to 100 millisieverts, so that there is no problem. But is this absolutely the correct judgment? If it is not absolute, then we should follow the precautionary principle and protect our children and descendants. We need to return to the basic principle of protecting our children's health and future. The national and local government's position does not allow for the collective evacuation of children who are victims of this man-made nuclear disaster. This policy, where the difficult path of voluntary evacuation is the only choice we have to protect our health and lives, denigrates human life and violates human rights. I hope that this situation will improve as soon as possible and that the human rights of the victims of this man-made catastrophe will be restored. There are two reasons why I'm speaking out now and will continue into the future. The first is my perspective as a victim of the nuclear accident. The second is my responsibility as a perpetrator of the disaster. I hope people around the world will join me and raise their voices so that children will not have their futures stolen away from them. Finally, I would like to read a poem that I wrote about this situation. Early afternoon, my son and daughter play beside me. My little girl giggles, toddling toward her big brother. "You love your big brother, don't you?" says my son proudly. "Is the radiation already harming my children? Has it entered their little bodies? Is there a way for me to take it all away from them? What is the purpose of adults who turn their heads and desert these children? Daddy and mommy will always protect you. Even if we die first, we will protect you forever."
Katsumi Hasegawa. The link to participate in the Matsumoto Project boarding school plan for Fukushima kids will be available on our website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog, under this episode, number 145. And in the coming weeks, we will have additional voices from Japan, direct address by the people being most deeply impacted by the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, speaking to you and the world, because they can't be heard in their own country. Note that this segment will always post in both English and Japanese versions. That poem always rips my heart out. So what does it mean to find yourself accidentally in proximity to a leaking nuclear reactor or a larger nuclear disaster or any nuclear site? That's my personal story, and I tell it in my new nuclear memoir, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and beyond. It's available as an ebook on Amazon Kindle, and you don't need to have a Kindle in order to read it. They will give you free software you can download to any digital device. You can check out the book for free by going to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, looking for the big yellow box, you really can't miss it, putting in your information and clicking. What that will do is get you an excerpt from the chapter that has me landing on the ground at Harrisburg only 5 days before the accident. For those of you who downloaded the book as my free gift to you on Friday, March 28th, it's the commemoration of the 35th anniversary of Three Mile Island. Once you read it, if you could post your 5-star review on Amazon, I would appreciate it. And if you missed the freebie, you can wait until next March 28th, that's in 2015, when it will again be available for free. Or you can just buy it now for about the same as a cup of Starbucks. Remember, with your purchase, you will not only be getting a terrific book, you'll also be supporting me and making it possible for me to continue my anti-nuclear work. And now, with the Radiation Weather Report, here's Mimi Gurman for Radcast.
This is Mimi Gurman for the Radcast Report, radically relevant and the first of its kind. Today is Tuesday, April 1st, 2014. We've been seeing fluctuations in readings across the United States over the past few days in the areas of Portland, Oregon, and Washington State, where counts were higher, and in the areas around the Great Lakes. Could this be from Fukushima? In the case of the Northwest, yes. What about New Mexico, Texas, or Oklahoma? That could be from the waste isolation plant. In the Great Lakes region, it could be from any of the four major nuclear plants, such as David Bessie with 14 high-level violations, or Kewaunee in Wisconsin, which had 9 violations in 2013, or the Perry Nuclear Generating Station in Ohio with 8 violations, or the Palisades Nuclear Power Plant in Michigan, which had 8 high-level violations. Some of these violations have resulted in radioactive water being discharged into the Great Lakes and into the air. We could go on and on about the events occurring, which would make us believe that our fluctuations are based not in fact necessarily from Fukushima, but by our own nuclear power plants in the United States. Today's readings are Salisbury, Massachusetts, 46 with a high of 74. Ithaca, New York, 47. Farmington, Michigan, 38 with a high of 58. Kings Heights, Oregon, which is near Portland, 32 with a whopping high of 66. Tenino, Washington, 37, which is a high count for them. And all the way over in Taiwan, 45 average with a high of 87. For all of the readings for the Radcast report for today, please go to radcast.org. This is Mimi Gurman for the Radcast report.
Here's today's final thought. I'm heading up to Washington State, where I will be giving at least one presentation in Yelm dealing with Fukushima, the WIP site, Hanford, Three Mile Island, plus a hefty dose of activism, what we can do on the local level to impact this global difficulty that we all face. I'm thrilled to learn that the demand has been so great that it looks like we're adding a second evening, this in the middle of the heartland of Washington. I couldn't be happier because these are people who want to get information and who sound like they're willing to step forward in a much bigger way to get active and make change. This is what I support with Nuclear Hot Seat, and I am now embarking on speaking engagements wherever possible. If you know of a corporation, a school, a church group, or just a local community that would like to bring me in as a speaker to ramp up local activities on nuclear issues, I would be thrilled to be able to provide that service. You can contact me by sending an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Know also that I am preparing either a teleseminar or a webinar series on nuclear health. This is a product that will be for sale, and the sale will directly impact and support my ability to keep doing this work. Those will be available as of May, and I will have all the information in the coming weeks. They are aimed at being an especially good information source for people who know nothing about the nuclear issue, but must if they are going to preserve their health, their life, and their genetic future. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 1st, 2014. And there are no April Fool jokes in the whole thing. It's all for real. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from ENENews.com, don't know what I would do without it, Metronews.ca, Steve Zeltzer and KPFA, King 5 News in Seattle and reporter Susanna Frame, Frontera Norte Sur, and the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community. Theme music written by me, sung by Marilee Weber. Looks like Weber, sounds like Weber. Nuclear Hot Seat is syndicated by UCY.tv. Our archive is available on iTunes or at nuclearhotseat.com. Click on the tab for the blog page. All comments are welcome as long as you keep them civil. Nuclear Hot Seat is the activist voice on nuclear issues. So if you have a hot tip, a story lead, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We also continue to look for ways to contact John Stewart because he needs me. Trust me, he needs me. Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2014, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed. You have my permission to reuse this as long as you are a nonprofit situation and provide proper attribution, meaning the website and my name. If you are a commercial media outlet, shoot me an email and let's talk. We're going to go out on another song from my not-yet-produced musical, Armageddon, The Living End. This is the show I was writing on when I found myself at Three Mile Island with a bullhorn going down the middle of the street, warning me that my life was about to change. This happens to be Michael Rupert's favorite song from the show, and it's called Ma Nature. Just imagine the old Mother Nature from Chiffon Margarine ads. For those of you too young to have seen this when it was new, check out YouTube. Only the poor deer has been beaten up really badly, and now she has had enough. This is Libby Halevi of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now don't go back to sleep, because we're all in the nuclear hot seat.
Stop, look around you, think, touch, smell, life is all around you, guard it well, reconsider what I'm worth, if you plan to stay on earth, I'm Mother Nature, don't mess with me. We need all this planet. Land, sea, air, take it from your mommy. You'd better care, think it through and have no doubt. See how time is running out. I'm Mother Nature, don't mess with me. There's no denying that slowly I'm dying. Incredible. Look what you're doing. It's Mother you're screwing. How Oedipal. Stop, look around you. Hear my voice. Keep it up and one day I'll have no choice. If your careless ways don't halt, it won't be San Andreas' fault.
Stop and look around you. Think, touch, smell. Everywhere a warning. Can't you tell? You don't have a way to leave. I will give you no reprieve.